Today we are talking to award-winning poet, writer, anthologist, and educator Naomi Shihab Nye. Welcome, Naomi.
Great to be here, Emmy.
I understand you call yourself a wandering poet. Tell us what that means to you.
Well, I've been an itinerant since I got out of college, in the sense that I never took one ongoing job, but I have visited countless schools and communities working with different groups. So after a while, that started seeming like wandering to me. And I love it. I think it's a life that is very precious.
What has been your journey and your passion to writing and poetry?
Well, the first part of my passion was simply loving to read and having a tremendous sense of satisfaction responding by writing things down myself. And I started writing and sending my work out as a child. And by the time I was in college, I was feeling more and more confident about doing research. Where do people send their work? Where do you discover potential friendly readers? And then working with children and people of all ages for so many years, I just keep feeling we're all involved in some kind of very simple but very meaningful exchange.
And when you say exchange, is that how you describe your poetry?
I think of poetry as an exchange. You know, you share an image or a story or something you've seen, something you've thought, and usually a reader will feel, hopefully, if you're lucky, some resonance in their own experience. And so it's back and forth, you know, kind of like, this is what I've seen. What have you seen? What could you tell me? What gives you meaning these days? What do you like to notice?
Mm-hmm. Who influenced your writings and your poetry?
Well, I was lucky to have a great teacher named Harriet Lane when I was in second grade in St. Louis. And I always feel that teachers are the heroes of our lives, and they give us so much more to go on than we ever can imagine, you know, during the year that we have them. I've been drawing on the wealth of Mrs. Lane's perspective about poetry all these years now, and I think she was absolutely right that every human being thinks in poetry and perceives life in very descriptive and fascinating ways. That metaphors occur to us all, you know, not just to poets. I walk around Jackson just listening to people talk, and I think I hear a poem or at least half a poem on every corner.
What is your philosophy on writing and poetry and how you keep that alive in your own life?
Well, I'm very, very regular and very relaxed about my writing. I write all the time. I've filled nearly an entire notebook in the past week in Wyoming. I'm not too precious about it. I don't wait around for a great idea, because I could probably live a long time without having one of those. But I have a lot of little ideas, and I have a lot of tiny attractions in language, in vision, in signage. You know that bridge you showed me for the herd to migrate over, mm-hmm. over the highway? Mm-hmm. I was writing some notes about that today, and I realized I have so many more questions to ask you about it. It's a fascinating thing. I mean, how will the elk know to go to that bridge? And I just have I have a lot of curiosity. So to me, I write about, you know, what's immediate, but many times it will connect you to something that's not right in your immediate zone. So you're not always writing just about what happened today, although I think it's a good place to begin for most of us to sort of stay tuned in.
How do you teach children to write? How do you teach them a love for poetry and writing?
You know, yesterday we saw some 14-year-old girls here who were so ready, did you notice, to read their poems after spending maybe 8 or 9 minutes writing, and they'd been taking notes before that and hearing some examples of poems. But I was very touched yesterday by their generosity, their willingness to share their own voices with their friends. And their poems were terrific. So what I try to encourage students to know is that they have continual access to their own thought process. Putting language on a page will help you see and feel your own thoughts more clearly. Mm-hmm. And then you get to select. You know, you can write 20 things down and then maybe select 3 that you'd like to use in whatever you're working on. Mm-hmm. And I think that process of selection is really an interesting factor, a determinant in kind of figuring out who we are and what appeals to us and what sort of imagery and language appeals to us. So I always try to get kids to say, you know, you want to be closer to your life? Write notes in a notebook. You want to pay better attention? Write notes down. You want to feel more interested, more creative, as if your mind has a few more spark plugs in it? Use writing. It's very simple, very cheap, very close to home, and you can do it every day. And I strongly believe, Emmy, that it will help you in everything else you do, because whatever you do in your life, you will be a user of language. Mm-hmm. So no matter what field you go into, if you're comfortable with your own writing and you know you can put down words that matter, you'll have a better go of it.
Do you write at the end of your day when you contemplate your day, or do you write at the beginning of your day?
I write at both.
Oh, do you?
Yes, and in the middle as well. Yes. But one thing I think people have sometimes the wrong idea about writers, and certainly we do sit at our desks sometimes for 5-6 hours when we're working on a project and, you know, we're not on location somewhere. But you can get a lot done if you're only writing in small increments too. Like if you're sitting down for 15 minutes three times a day, that's a lot of time with mm-hmm. a page. And just think about how much you'll write down, or even 7 minutes three times a day, or 7 minutes two times a day. You know, you'll get a lot written down more quickly than you might imagine. Now, of course, when you're working on crafting, revising, shaping your work, it's great to have hours of really deep concentration. But that's not necessary for daily writing. And I'm interested in encouraging people to do daily writing.
I liked when you gave an example of how you had written a huge amount, and then in the end, your poem ended up being like 4 sentences.
Right. I like to overwrite and then cut back. It's relaxing. You know, you feel like you don't have to make such precise decisions before you've even put something on the page. So I tend to write more than I will need and then mm-hmm. just cut. Mm-hmm. And I like to say that to students because I don't want them to feel so nervous about, you know, is every line that I write the best line, the perfect line, the right line? I just say write any line and then you can work with it. You know, it's much easier to work with something once you have it on the paper. I think really this is applicable to writers of every age too. You know, when I met quite a few people around Wyoming this week of, say, an older retired age who were phenomenal. They're just beautiful people in this state. And many of them said, you know, I've been thinking about, I really would like to write a little more about my mother, or I'd like to do a little memoir for my family, or, you know, many people have different kinds of writing projects they've been meditating on. And what I always urge them to do is just start anywhere, kind of dive in. You don't have to keep that as your beginning, you know, mm-hmm. down the road, that might end up being the middle of what you're writing. But just don't wait too long to have it all shaped in your mind. I think that's one of the most common phobias people develop. Like, well, I need to get it, you know, more clearly.
I need to get it just right.
Yeah, but I need to get it right in my mind. No, you don't. Mm. Just get words on the page and then start thinking about how you want it to flow and what you want to cut. And, you know, just allow yourself that time, that expanse. I like a word like expanse in Wyoming. And I live in Texas. We take horizons and wide open spaces very seriously too. And I think when you write, you need to keep that in mind. Right. Your page is a wide open space and it is waiting for you to walk across it.
What was it? I heard you quote one time on an interview something that William Stafford said to you about being a poet.
Well, he often would say, not just to me, but to audiences, when people would ask him, like, when did you become a poet in your life? He would grin and he would say, well, that's not really the right question. The question is, when did you stop being a poet, if you feel like you aren't one? Because all little children and toddlers are poets. And some of us just try to keep up the habit. And I really loved how that, you know, kind of gives it back to every person as part of your birthright. If you're a human being, you live with language. You may have a richer life with language just by doing a few very simple things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, Emmy, one thing I sometimes say to people is I've been wandering a long time now and met so many people who like to write of all ages, and I've never met anyone who said that the devoted habit of writing was useless. You know, that they've been writing in a notebook and it did nothing for them. Or I've never met anyone who said they wished they hadn't been writing. But many times you meet people who say, you know, I didn't write for those years when my kids were little or when I had so much going on, but I really need to now. No.
I bet they wish they had. Your kids say so many fun things.
Yeah, kids say so many fun things. And just, I mean, so much occurs, so much circulates around us all the time. And I just feel it helps satisfy some human desire to feel story, that you're in a story at all mm-hmm. times. You're not just drifting off like a piece of dust in the atmosphere by yourself. You're part of an ongoing story. You know, everybody in Jackson today is part of Jackson's story of this day. And I think sometimes we just keep finding threads and kind of gravities and anchors when we write. And we have no idea how many there might be.
How has your cultural heritage influenced your writing? Being Palestinian, your father was Palestinian, your mother was American.
Right. Well, it was very interesting growing up in a bicultural household, and I really treasure it looking back on that rich mixture. You know, I didn't feel that it was strange because it was the only thing I knew. And I was growing up in a fairly multicultural neighborhood in St. Louis, surrounded by French Canadians, Italian Americans, you know, African Americans, people of different backgrounds. So it just was sort of, you know, people come from different places. Here we are. Who are we? I didn't really start writing a lot about culture and ethnicity till I was older, maybe in college. That's when it really started striking me that it was very, very precious to have a parent who was an immigrant and who had just given you a different sense of the world than someone whose parents had, say, both grown up down the block from one another. So I saw it as a wealth. I saw it as kind of a fascinating, sometimes complicated mixture. Mm-hmm. You know, my parents didn't always get along, but whose parents do? I mean, there's often a buzz of friction, whether or not they're from the same culture. But they were both very intelligent people who loved language, loved art and culture, loved exposure to whatever was given, you know, say, by community. If there was a free theater program in Forest Park in St. Louis, where I lived first, we were there. If there was, you know, symphony concert and my mom could scrape together money for the tickets, we were there. So there was a sense as children that, you know, wow, all this art, there's so much in the world, you know, what are we going to do? And I feel very lucky to have had early exposure to many realms of art.
That really opened up your mind and your eyes to see the...
It did. And, you know, one thing I've been harping on in my own community of San Antonio recently is I think we all need to be fans. We need to be very strong fans for one another. And we really need to step out, you know, no matter how long we've lived there, or how much we think we know, who our favorite bands are, who our favorite poets are, you know, locally or painters or whatever. But we need to keep discovering the new ones, the ones we don't know. You know, who are these young kids playing down the block? Well, I've never heard them. I need to be there. So I'm always urging people to cross over from their own disciplines a little bit more and be a fan to other people. Mm-hmm. I think more needs to be said out loud about that, too. I can't stand the sort of sophisticated or pseudo-sophisticated attitude like, oh, I'm so cool. I don't have to be a fan of anyone. I think we should be fans of tons of people. And if we're awake and alive and, you know, curious about the world as we're seeing it, it seems like we'd want to know how other people are seeing it. So that's just one of my frequent thoughts. And many times I'll meet, oh, people who'll say, you know, oh, I've lived here so many years and, you know, we have great museums in my city, like you have great galleries and museums here in Jackson. And people will say, oh, I've never been there. And I just want to say, why not? Why are you holding back? I mean, usually museums have at least one free night a week. You know, step out. I think we need to be more curious in our lives.
In our surroundings.
In our immediate surroundings. Mm-hmm. Because many times we can become a little, I don't know, jaded or cavalier, like, oh, I know what's in San Antonio. You know, I can just stay in my same old groove. But I don't. It's new every day. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's true in most places.
How much time did you spend in Jerusalem?
We only lived there about a year and a half, and I went back many times. And we left because of war, again, war. But I went back many times to be with my grandmother, who lived to be 106, to take our son when he was born and growing up so he could know his great-grandmother, to travel with my father many times back. So I go to the Middle East as often as I can.
And do you speak Arabic?
I don't. I mean, I'm so ashamed. I studied Arabic. I understand a lot. And I can do, like, you know, kitchen Arabic and a little bit of chatter and so forth. But I also studied Spanish and German. And I'm afraid that my language center in my brain is very weak because it mixes the three languages up. So I speak a strange hodgepodge of Spanish with a few Arabic words thrown in. And, you know, German is the worst of all three of them. But I love German. But I just, you know, I don't use it that much, so...
How did you talk to your grandma?
Well, I did have to speak to her in my pidgin Arabic because she spoke no English. Mm-hmm. So she was very patient with me, and she used to say to me, I mean, we spoke enough together that we could have real conversations and so mm-hmm. forth. And then when things got technical, I would drag in one of my bilingual cousins to help me. Like if the story got too involved, like what is she saying right now? What is this about? Mm-hmm. She used to tell me that if I would just... you know, come and stay a couple of years, I would be fluent. And I'm sure that would have been true. Because the longer I would stay with her, I would get more fluent every day. And, you know, some people are great with languages. I think I may have started too late. I think that center in my brain may have been already calcifying or something. Because, you know, I'm surrounded by young kids who are bilingual and trilingual, you know, all the time. And I just think, you know, what was wrong with me? I love language. Why have I studied three but still can only really speak one?
I think it's the total immersion.
Yeah.
I do think that makes the difference.
I think it makes a huge difference.
Did she influence your writing, your grandma?
Well, she didn't even write. She was illiterate. But her stories and her spirit influenced my writing. The way she told a story, she had a very punchy sense of timing. And I remember watching how people who sat around her fire, she loved having a little fire in this dangerous fire kettle in the evenings, and she would crack almonds and sit around the fire and talk. People would circle around, kind of a very old-fashioned, traditional way, you know, like in so many cultures. People gather around the fire and share stories. But I could see from the ways people would react, even when she was speaking Arabic too fast for me to follow the story closely, that she had a tremendous sense of timing. Like everybody would burst into laughter at the same moment. So that sort of pacing that she had, her punchy way of answering, you know, I have thought sometimes, I hope I write poems that she would have liked had she spoken English, because that rhythm of her spirit is very much in my head. And my father had it too. He was sort of, I think his rhythm, he was a journalist. He liked very short sentences. He had a distrust of adjectives. He liked nouns, verbs, you know, strong, simple lines. I think he modeled himself on the way she spoke and the world he had grown up in. And so certainly he influenced my writing. He loved writing so much. I mean, he would just scribble on everything and always be taking notes. Since he was a journalist, he was always, you know, stumbling upon a story somewhere, and you'd be out to dinner and the next thing you know, he's interviewing the cook in the kitchen or the man at the next table. He used to tell us to read newspapers very carefully and ask a lot of questions about what might be left out of that story, which is something I really appreciate.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you what your father did.
Yeah. He started as a radio journalist when he was a teenager. Okay. He worked for the BBC. And then when he was in college and beyond that, he worked as a newspaper journalist. And he loved, you know, news. He loved composing both his own essays and own stories as well as newspaper stories. But we used to have the scissors in the middle of our dining room table, always where we were supposed to cut out news stories that we wanted to keep and think more about later. You know, he really urged us to find, you know, he would say, people throw away newspapers too quickly. There's always something that you should be, you know, saving and looking up more info on. And he would also or just to tell him when there were grammatical errors that we found in a story. He was kind of a grammar police. So was my mother. They both really liked proper grammar. And so he would say, you know, if you see a misuse of language in that story, cut it out and I'll take it back to the newspaper and I'll find out who wrote it. Yeah. And I used to think, gee, Dad, some people just relax when they read the newspaper. You want us to be like critiquing the newspaper.
The police.
Yeah. But I loved just having that sense of, you know, there's always a lot happening around us. And I think my father felt a lot of grief about, you know, so many stories about violence and war, and, you know, how so many stories are about ugly things, bad things. Mm-hmm. And he was always a promoter of the feature about the amazing person, or, mm-hmm. you know, the wonderful story, the beautiful story. He thought newspapers should be a little more balanced, including more, you know, positive stories. And so he did that as often as he could.
How do you think technology has influenced our young people in terms of writing, reading, and crafting a poem?
Well, you know, I read this interview recently with the poet laureate of the UK, Carol Ann Duffy, who's from Scotland. I've been loving her poems for about 20 or 30 years, so I was so happy when she got honored in this way. And she said that she really favors technology and texting and so forth because it's a use of language. And she said, texting is really like a poem. You're trying to say something in as few words as possible to convey a message to someone. She described having grown up in a bookless house herself, that her parents were not readers. They didn't read to their children. And so she had to go out searching for books and magazines and going to the library and so forth. And she said, you know, for kids to have technology and be able to read so many things, you know, in their palms or on their desks, she finds that very good. I think it's excellent to have access to so many things through technology. The one thing I notice is that it seems our attention spans are diminishing, and that worries me. I mean, I even feel my own attention span diminishing. And when you read like little tiny chunks of news or just a few sentences about each story, you can really feel the difference when you read like an in-depth story in a magazine that still takes the time to write, you know, a deep, in-depth story. Like the one on immigration you and I just talked about.
Exactly.
That was an in-depth story.
Right.
And it was also personal as well as collective. I mean, it was very rounded. We're referring to the story by, is his name Jose Antonio Vargas?
Right.
That was just a cover story about immigrants in Time magazine called We Are All Americans. And it's a very moving story because he takes the time to examine it from so many perspectives. But I guess I would worry that we become so impatient that we only want like a phrase to, mm-hmm. to give us the news. That's not enough.
Right. And yeah. to have the understanding.
Right. To have the rounded understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Will you read a poem for us?
Sure. Well, I'd like to read this one for the Teton County Library because I'm very grateful to them for being so friendly to me here in Jackson and co-sponsoring my visit and all the good work they do in this community. So this is thinking of all the libraries we love. This is called Because of Libraries, We Can Say These Things. She is holding the book close to her body, carrying it home on the cracked sidewalk down the tangled hill. If a dog runs at her again, she will use the book as a shield. She looked hard among the long lines of books to find this one. When they start talking about money, when the day contains such long and hot places, she will go inside. An orange bed is waiting, story without corners. She will have two families. They will eat at different hours. She is carrying a book past the fire station and the five and dime. What this town has not given her, the book will provide. A sheep. A wilderness of new solutions. The book has already lived through its troubles. The book has a calm cover, a straight spine. When the step returns to itself as the best place for sitting, and the men up and down the street are latching their clippers, she will not be alone. She will have a book to open and open and open. Her life starts here.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so sweet. And I think, you know, the line about the sheep, I have to say something about that. I always was fascinated by sheep when I was a little child. But, of course, I didn't have one. I didn't know one. I just liked sheep as an animal. And the other day in Wyoming, I had the most amazing experience being in a vehicle behind about 2,000 sheep that were being herded from one pasture to another outside of the town of KC. And there were sheepdogs herding them. And it was one of the most astonishing, overwhelming experiences I've ever had in my life. And finally, a farmer drove up and said to us in the car, just go through them, drive through them. And our friend Marcia, who was driving, she didn't want to. She said, oh, I don't want to do that. And there were little lambs, and they were suckling from their mothers and bleating and crying. And I just felt all the sheep love of my entire childhood was like giving me goosebumps. I thought, oh, my God, who would have ever thought I would get to see this many sheep doing their own sheepy thing, like moving to another pasture? It was amazing. I mean, I do feel like being in Wyoming gives us access to so many beautiful experiences that are visual, that are deep, that are wild, that, you know, you don't have to own things to feel as if somehow you are owned by the beauty that this state contains. I really honor and respect you all.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm very, very lucky to be here.
You make me love Wyoming so much when you came last time and we drove around the state and you kept looking up at the sky and saying, there's no night pollution here.
It's so beautiful at night and the day. And yeah, it's a wondrous state.
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Emmy.